Log Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us once again on Queensbury Rules Radio. This is Patrick Connor of QueensburyRules.com. Also here with us, as always, our booking agent and secretary, James Foley of BadLeftHook.com. James?
How you doing, Patrick?
I am great, dude. We have a pretty good show today, and I'm pretty excited for it. But I got to tell you, I'm going to take this opportunity right now to continue on the boo for the brush. Boo! Boo. I don't like the brush.
Well, it wasn't the worst part of the post-fight interview this time.
Yeah, that's true. Got a little bit heated. They had to separate Adrian Broner and Paul Malignaggi. It was something about side pieces and bragging, and I don't know, give us the lowdown.
I don't know what happened there, you know. Those things sometimes can be kind of entertaining, but, you know, you like to see, after the fight's over, guys act like gentlemen and show some sportsmanship. And I think Paulie was trying to do that. You know, Broner didn't need to do what he did in the post-fight interview. But, you know, that's Adrian Broner. I mean, I think he just doesn't know how to not play that character anymore. And he's kind of falling into that problem. But I wanted to ask you, you know, so basically what happened, Broner was going up in weight from lightweight to welterweight. He pretty handily, I think, dismantled and outclassed Malignaggi. Didn't knock him out, but, you know, he was never really in any kind of jeopardy, and I thought he won the fight relatively easily. I was kind of surprised to see some closer scorecards that were out there. I mean, I thought 8-4, 9-3 kind of seemed to be the right type of range. But it just seemed like a lot of the chatter after the fight was that this was some kind of a condemnation of Broner, that, you know, Paulie wasn't being carried out on a stretcher, so therefore Broner is now, you know, been exposed, and suddenly his bright future looks like he's the, people calling him the next Andre Berto, and I would favor Maidana over Broner, and, you know, a lot of people were not really impressed with his performance on Saturday night. Now, do you think that this was a case of maybe Paulie just exceeding expectations and people seeing things closer than they really were, or, you know, is this really a death knell for his future superstar prospects? Has no other budding young contender ever had a tough fight in the history of boxing, or a closer than expected fight?
Well, they certainly have, although I think that when you put all of it together, you know, I don't really know how many fans Broner actually lost. I think that that's probably an exaggeration. I think that the numbers and the interest and the trends on Twitter and Facebook and all that type of stuff, I think they pretty much speak for themselves, and that, you know, he has basically copied Floyd Mayweather just enough in persona that basically now, you know, people are tuning in just to see him lose as well. It's not so much that he has a ton of fans and all that type of stuff, but he's just being a controversial figure, you know, putting his act forth in a way that people either say that is hilarious and I want to see more, or fuck that guy, I want to see him lose. So, I mean, he's doing the right things. In terms of his actual performance in Malignaggi, I think that Malignaggi probably, he put forth a pretty good effort. He landed some really good body punches in spots, but his lack of power really told. And I think that when you look at Adrian Broner and, you know, the hype and all that type of stuff, I think that there's probably bound to be some sort of letdown sooner or later. But, you know, Paul Malignaggi, it's tough to really look good against him. There are only a couple of, you know, fairly elite guys have done it. He's tough to stop. He's got a good chin. But the point is that, you know, going forward, I think that people are kind of looking at this, you know, the Adrian Broner situation with a little bit more of a skeptical eye.
I think you're probably right, but I don't think that should necessarily be the case. You know, I mean, I think Malignaggi's, he's a solid professional. He's not a bum. And he put on a really inspired, spirited performance. And I thought that he, you know, as far as his effort and his game plan, he really fought a great fight. I mean, he looked much better than he did against Pablo Cano. But, you know, Broner still was just able to, you know, time him and block most of those punches and catch him with these really clean counter shots. And I just didn't, I didn't see it being competitive. And I'd predicted that I thought Broner was going to just completely overwhelm him and end up stopping him. And on that front, I was completely wrong about it. But, you know, I don't think it's really an indictment of Broner that he went out there and racked up a pretty clean, you know, 116, 112-ish type of decision. Never really got hurt. I mean, yeah, Paulie might have landed a couple body shots and some kind of grazing head shots here and there, but not once did Broner ever seem really perturbed by it, other than, you know, defending himself when Paulie would throw, you know, like maybe 7 or 8 punch combinations and Broner would go on the defensive for a second. But, I think he showed a lot of the same kind of tools that get people so excited about him. And it, to me, it's another case of the perception of it going into the fight. People don't like the guy, and that's totally understandable. He's not very likable. You know, he's set up this persona around himself. Like you said, it's the Mayweather blueprint. And Broner actually seems to have kind of even less, like, you know, charisma and awareness about what lines he should cross and what he should say. And he is very, I mean, I can understand there being a lot of negativity. And he also, you know, any fighter who's been handed so many opportunities, maybe a little bit prematurely, there's always going to be a little bit of a backlash. And so I think people saw this fight and saw Paulie give a great effort and hang in there and go the 12 rounds and have a couple some moments of success, and it kind of played into the story that they wanted to see, which is of Broner being exposed and falling short, and, you know, this kind of revealing that he's never going to be on an elite level, which I think is a complete joke. I mean, people, to read that, all of that from one fight, it just, I think, you know, these things take years to develop. And I heard people saying after the fight things like, Mayweather barely ever loses a round, you know, and people are comparing Broner to Mayweather. Well, it's like, go back and watch Mayweather's early career. He had tough fights. He had fights where he lost rounds, even fights he came back and stopped the guys, you know, so that's just a load of crap. I mean, this happens to fighters, you know, but the rounds that Broner lost here, a lot of it was just because he was just being outworked. You know, I never thought that he was in any kind of serious jeopardy of losing the fight, of being hurt. It just seemed like, you know, he is very methodical, and he's not as, you know, he does take some time off in rounds. But I'll also say this. I thought the fight was actually pretty entertaining because I had kind of low expectations. And I heard a lot of people saying that they didn't really, you know, care for it that much. I thought it was reasonably entertaining, and maybe I'm kind of a sucker for the clowning and all the talking and smirking and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I think this was kind of the best-case scenario for the way that this fight could have played out, aside from, you know, Paulie miraculously finding power overnight and, you know, giving him a Marquez at the end of one of those rounds.
Well, I mean, like I said before, the lack of power certainly was telling. However, it's an old boxing adage, basically, that one guy wins a round, not so much because of what the other guy did, but what he didn't do. And so that's kind of like a, you know, as they say, just almost like an axiom at this point. It's something that gets repeated so often that it's basically just, you know, it holds a little bit of truth. But I think that it definitely holds true for this fight in that, you know, I think there were points at which if Broner really would have opened up with a solid 2-3-4 punch combination, he probably could have dumped Paulie right on his ass. But he elected to focus more on defense, you know, clown, talk. I didn't like the fouling. You know, overall, I didn't think it was a bad performance from Broner. But if there's one thing I could take away from it, was that I really didn't like was the fouling. I didn't like the fouling. I thought it was pretty blatant, and he was doing it in a way that he was just like, "Look at me. I'm not going to get penalized. So I'm just going to keep doing some crazy shit, like on the break, you know, elbowing Paulie in the back and."
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
Punching
I agree
him on the break, the kicking and stuff like that was a little much for me.
Pretty ridiculous. But I think that was just another, you know, another one of the antics that were going on in this fight. I mean, it was part of the same kind of stuff that was happening in the, you know, the build-up. I mean, I think it just was just a goofy promotion, and at times in the ring it was the same way.
No, for sure. And, I mean, you know, there are good things to take from the fight, but I think that also on the other
hand...
Sorry,
Patrick. Your boy's calling in now, and his area code's 571, by the way.
Okay, perfect. There are good things to take away from it, but at the same time, I think that you also have to kind of, you know, take into account that Adrian Broner is making his own bed. And so if people are going to, you know, hate on him or exaggerate or whatever, I'm not saying I support it, but at the same time, you know, he kind of brings it on himself. And
it's understandable.
On that note, I am patching through Mr. Mulvaney. Kieran Mulvaney, thank you so much for joining us.
The pleasure is all mine.
I kind of doubt that. We're really digging your accent, and we're looking forward to it.
No, it is.
Huge,
I mean,
fans
you have
of
no idea how rarely I ever talk to anybody, so this is great.
All right.
Well, we read about your expeditions in the Alaskan wilderness and going to Antarctica, so I can imagine that maybe you get a little bit of seclusion in your time.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, for those that don't know, Mr. Kieran Mulvaney writes for ESPN. He covers boxing for them. He also writes for a blog for the Discovery Channel, and he also writes for Reuters. So he's not just a boxing writer. He's more of a writer who writes about boxing, you know, when he wants to, and he's pretty damn good at it. So we're really happy to have you on the show, Kieran. And we wanted to, you know, get your opinions on a handful of things while we have the time.
Cool.
I think that James was going to go ahead and take us into some stuff.
Oh, yeah, I got one for you, Kieran. And thanks for coming on, of course. Should I do this before we do? Do you want to get some quick Malignaggi Broner thoughts while we're on the topic? Because I got something completely unrelated. Patrick, this is up to you.
Sorry. Well, I guess since we were just talking about Adrian Broner, Paulie Malignaggi, as, you know, pretty much everybody is, except for Mayweather Canelo, since the press conference is today. We actually just kind of wanted to get your opinion on the fight, what you thought about how it should be scored. And, of course, since I was just talking about it, the fouling, what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, anyway, Kieran, also, if you could just touch on, too, kind of this notion of fight fans and writers making so much from one performance.
To take that last one, I think that what you take out of the Malignaggi Broner fight, as with many fights, right, depends on what you go into it with. And there were a lot of folks who were incredibly dismissive of this fight and thought it would be just a blowout. And for them, probably the fact that it was not is something of a black mark on Broner. You know, those of us who thought that Broner was almost certain to win, but the Malignaggi would put up a pretty good fight, I think saw pretty much to some extent what we expected. I think what's interesting for me about Adrian Broner, I've been following him for actually a couple of years now and spent some time with him, you know, for HBO and all of that, is I think he's a tremendously talented fighter, and I have done for a long time. I think he's really very good. I think the question, however, is to me, looking at him against Malignaggi, whether he's becoming a bit too satisfied with himself and his own ability. You know, Malignaggi's a tough guy. He's hard to get out of there. The two guys who stopped him just stopped him with volumes of punches, right? And that's not the kind of guy that Adrian Broner is. But nonetheless, I would have liked to have seen him step forward more to try to do more, to try to really make a statement that he didn't seem to be particularly interested in making. He just seemed interested in just taunting Paulie and just getting there to the end and, you know, and kicking them in the nuts. And so I think in that respect, it was disappointing. I was extraordinarily disappointed in both men in terms of the way they conducted themselves before and after the fight. I thought it was a tremendous black mark on boxing. It's one of the reasons I chose not to go there, actually. Trash talk is one thing. I think outright misogyny is something entirely different. So basically, I think that I still maintain that Broner is a tremendous talent. I think we're beginning to see the kind of people who might give him difficulty in the ring. It won't happen because they're very close, but stylistically, a Devin Alexander would be just the kind of guy, I think, to give Broner fits, potentially. But that will never happen. So... An Amir Khan fight might be interesting because offensively he'll have the kind of punch output to make Bronner, you know, put Bronner in some difficulties, but he's so defensively vulnerable that he'd be open to those Bronner counters. I think that would be an intriguing fight. But I still think that Bronner is potentially very good in the ring. I think that perhaps the biggest problem that he's going to have is that he's a bit too satisfied with himself. He's getting a bit caught up in his own act. I'm not sure how dedicated he is to his own fitness. He looked like he was getting a bit heavy at the end there. And I suspect that Adrian Bronner is probably going to be Adrian Bronner's biggest enemy in the short to medium term.
I would definitely agree with that.
I completely agree with what you said about the promotion. You know, a lot of people were like, oh, man, it's this great trash talk going on. But, I mean, really, they spent more time attacking women than attacking each other. You know,
exactly.
So much of the rhetoric was just terribly offensive. And then to see people, I mean, if you're Steven Espinoza and you're sitting at that press conference, I mean, at least pretend like you're somewhat bothered by this instead of just chuckling about, you know.
And I think they're going to have, I suspect that they are going to have words with Paulie. They wanted the fight to be done. But I think there is discomfort within Showtime at some of the things that their analyst said and the way that he behaved, including after the fight. And I think they're going to have conversations with him. And indeed, some of the tweets that he sends out, not just toward Bronner, but generally, you know, even though it would be extraordinarily entertaining on its own level, you don't see Steve Farhood and Al Bernstein go off at each other about stealing each other's side pieces. So,
we have it on good authority that they've traded side pieces a few times over the years.
Yeah, I think Farhood's up 2-1 on that at the moment.
Ooh, I would have guessed that.
Yeah, look. Well, there you go. I mean, I think Paulie's got a good gig going. He can be quite insightful. He can be quite charming. He can be quite intelligent. And you somewhat expected it a little bit from Bronner, because I think if Bronner had a second brain cell, it would double what he's got going on in that skull. I really don't think Adrian Bronner is a very bright man at all. But Paulie, one expects to have the capability to regulate himself a little bit better, and I think that was disappointing that he didn't.
I agree. So on the topic of women, that kind of ties into what I'm going with next here. So Kieran, imagine yourself at one of your swank beltway black tie dinners. You know, you're having, I'm not sure what your drink of choice is, but I'm sure it's something, you know, something respectable. And across the room from you, you gaze across the room and you see the lovely Elizabeth Shue herself. Rumor has
she wouldn't be across the room from me.
Right.
The problem with your premise there.
Rumor has it that you've been dating, but in this hypothetical, we'll just pretend like this is the first time you've met her. And, of course, you make your approach. You're regaling her with tales of your environmentalism and, you know, all the things that you do with science and for discovery, and she's melting in your hands. But then you make the vital mistake of mentioning that you're a boxing writer. And immediately she counters with, how can you be a fan of this barbaric sport? These guys punching each other in the head. And, you know, I mean, look what happened to Muhammad Ali. And it's this, you know, the damage that these men take. It's primitive. It's just wrong. You know, it's so violent. And what is your response to that?
To Elizabeth, I completely agree. I'm only doing it to destroy the sport from inside. but on a serious level, it's a question I'm sure we all ask ourselves this, right, and go through this. And it's something that I've been asking myself a lot. I go through phases of being a bit disenchanted, sometimes even a bit embarrassed by the sport. I have a very, very, very conflicted feeling about the sport. And all the more so since I've just been doing a little bit of writing and research into some work that the Ruvo Center for Brain Health in Las Vegas has been doing, looking at long-term studies of brain damage in boxers. And I wrote a little piece about that for ESPN last year, and I'm hoping to do a much larger piece looking at both acute and chronic brain damage. And not even just the brain damage, it's just the whole aspect of the way that the sport is run. And those of us who've met fighters, retired fighters, and know how incredibly sad so often it is, right, that that it's a sport that doesn't look after its own, that requires sacrifices of his athletes beyond those which even other sports do, and then just spits them out at the end. I do go through a lot of doubts about it. And to be honest, you know, not wanting to like over-dramatize it or talk about it too much, things like the Bronner-Malinagi build-up really made me feel pretty... It's distasteful, and there's so much about the sport. There are times when I'm embarrassed about it, right?
That would play really well with Elizabeth, by the way.
Meanwhile, while I'm stammering along like this, she's walked off, and I haven't realized that there's a ketchup stain on my tuxedo shirt. But you know, like say for example on Twitter, you know, I tweet about science, I tweet about climate, about oceans, as well as boxing. And there are times, sometimes I think about some of the science writing peers looking at my boxing tweets and rolling their eyes, thinking, "Geez, what does Kieran do this stuff for?" Sometimes I think I wish I was writing about a less embarrassing sport. But I am conflicted about it. I'm a huge admirer of boxers as athletes, and the more time I spend around the sport, I'm all the more admiring of what they do, and all the more despondent about all the stuff that goes on around it, really.
So, I mean, you kind of just touched on it at the very end there, but I mean, what is the real appeal for you, I guess? Like, what, you know, how would you defend the sport against those who might say that it, you know, because I have the same conflict. That's why where this question is based from. You know, you do get squeamish sometimes when you think about the real damage that these guys are taking, and ultimately, yeah, I mean, they're getting paid, and it's for their own self-interest, but from our perspective, you know, we are kind of the modern day, you know, watching the gladiator ring.
Yes. And I mean, my admiration for them is as athletes and what they're able to do. And it was interesting. I went to the first conference that had been held on CTE, you know, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, the disease that, you know, everyone talks about because of football, and obviously it's huge in boxing. And I sat and I talked to this guy, Robert Cantu, who is one of the leading guys on CTE and on sports concussions. And I was talking to him about it, and I was interviewing him. And then at the end, I said, look, the reason that I'm specifically here is I got into this through boxing. I said, I'm a science writer, but I'm also a boxing writer. And obviously, this has real importance, you know. And I said, I'm kind of curious. I want to ask you, what do you think about boxing? And I thought, you know, I felt for sure that here's this guy who studies people's brains getting mashed up. And surely he's going to say, well, good Lord, it's barbaric. But he said, you know what? He said, I would never, ever encourage anybody to be a boxer. He goes, but I did once do a study out of curiosity, out of the primary cause of non-natural death of professional boxers. And he goes, and most of them get shot. And that's because those are the environments that they come from. And the fact is that still, until there are other different opportunities for folks who come from those social strata that boxers tend to come from, non-Klitschko boxers tend to come from, you know, it is at least some kind of outlet, and at least some of these guys do have an opportunity to earn some money and some, you know, some fame and live a pretty decent life. But it is still a conflict, and the way that I deal with it is I tend to write almost invariably just about the fighters themselves. I tend not to get into all the other the politics. I tend not to big up the promoters or do anything like that. I think the best thing I can do is focus on the fighters and try to be compassionate towards the fighters, because these are guys who are putting themselves on the line all the time. But I'd be lying if I didn't say that there weren't times where I was extraordinarily embarrassed that somehow over the last 10 years a chunk of my time has been spent devoted to writing about boxing, even though I find myself drawn to it.
You know, speaking of things that you're drawn to, I actually wanted to ask you about something, you know, that I guess kind of involves less embarrassing sports. For some reason, you seem to have a fascination with Tombstone, Arizona.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, because I've read a couple of the pieces that you've written, basically on that kind of era, that lifestyle, and you know, in particular Tombstone. So I wanted to ask you about what exactly drew you to Tombstone and why you like the movie so much.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about, like, big fights, right? That one lasted 30 seconds, and we're still talking about it 130 years later. So, you know, it was the movie that started it, right? I didn't know very much about the history at all. And I think, like, anybody else who's seen that movie, Tombstone, specifically what it is Val Kilmer and his just incredible role as Doc Holliday. And the lines, right? I mean, it's brilliant writing, isn't it? I mean, it's just, there's just some absolute classic lines. It's one of those movies that anyone who's seen it a couple of times can recite a whole bunch of lines. And
I know a lot of people try to make Quaid's Doc Holliday better, you know, like classically and all this type of stuff, but I got to disagree. Come on, Kilmer as Holliday is the best.
Well, exactly. And you know what's interesting is that, and folks in Tombstone will say exactly that, right? That the Quaid is probably the better historical representation. And in many ways, the whole thing is that Costner movie is more accurate because Wyatt Earp was actually probably a pretty boring guy. But as a consequence, his movie's a bit dull. But the guy who until recently played Doc Holliday, his role is to walk up and down the streets of Tombstone being Doc Holliday, says he didn't model himself on Doc Holliday, he modeled himself on Val Kilmer as Doc Holliday because that's become the iconic representation of him. And what I was fascinated by was the fact that, to me, it's amazing, right? Like in 1880, London was pretty sophisticated. It was the Victorian era, was in full swing. The Industrial Revolution was in full swing. Europe was powerful and rich. And the East Coast was you know, powerful and rich. And yet, out west, still, there was this, you know, sort of frontier law. The fact that it was so so different so recently. I mean, it was only 130 years ago, 1881, the gunfight.
Arizona's still crazy.
Well, yeah, I actually feel like I understand a little bit more about Arizona today now after being out there and studying the gunfight and all. And it was really interesting how, in a strange way, that gunfight, what I found very interesting. So I watched the movie, and then I realized that Tombstone, the town, still existed. I went to my editor at the Washington Post magazine and asked if I could go out and write something about it. And for me, it was really interesting. In the sense, it was the end of that particular era. It was the transition into the holy cow, we've got to get some law and order around here kind of a thing. And also the fact that ultimately, the fact that there were so many different elements went into that gunfight, North versus South, urban versus rural, the Earps and the mercantile society against the ranchers. But at the end of the day, basically what happened was a lot of people got drunk and they met in an alley and shot at each other. And that's basically what it comes down to. And yet that has become just a really seminal moment in U.S. history. And I find it absolutely fascinating.
That happens after boxing fights.
Exactly. During them, sometimes. You know, more people in Brooklyn were interested in the fights going on in the stands than Mitchell and Banks going at each other.
Yeah.
Have you sought out all the different film versions of that story?
No, there's a lot, especially some of the older ones that I haven't seen, like My Darling Clementine.
Yeah, I was going to recommend that. That's a great one. I think that's probably the only other one that I know.
Yeah, I should sit down and watch that. They have, at the OK Corral in Tombstone, they have this great hokey, what they call historama, which is this moving diorama with old movies narrated by Vincent Price, of all people, that they put together in like 1962. That's the history of Tombstone. And in this little theater where they show it, they have all these great posters of different Tombstone-related movies that have been made over the years, just tons and tons and tons of them.
You know, I actually, so transitioning away from that just a little bit, but I'm also kind of curious about something else about you. So I was reading your, kind of like your biography on your website, just because I was curious, because, you know, past the science stuff and past your fascination with Tombstone, I didn't really know a ton about, you know, what you had done before getting into boxing. And so I was just curious how basically you decided to go from pretty much, as you describe it, a full-time activist to a writer and to kind of getting into a different element of the issue.
I think at heart I was always a writer. The accident was stumbling into being an activist because I think I've always sort of had something of the writer's sensibility that I always like to write. But that because I started to try to do that at a, I think at a young age, when you know you're generally filled with righteous anger about things, I've wound up becoming more of an activist, and you know, certainly using my writing ability within that, but. At the same time, you can only sort of do that for a while, right? You can only bang your head against the wall for a certain number of years before it starts to hurt.
I don't mean to suggest that being a writer is anything less than what you were doing.
Sure.
But you know, that it's a different kind of approach of you know
sure.
towards approaching these particular issues.
Sure, and I think one of the reasons why I stopped doing the full-time activism is that even though I have like quite strong viewpoints on certain number of issues and so that people aren't wondering what we're talking about vaguely, it's particularly in environmental activism that I worked on, that I always had that writer's sensibility of perhaps seeing the occasional shade of gray, whereas you tend to have to deal with black and white if you're involved in activism. And it just got a bit tiring and you start to get a bit old for it. Well, at least I did. And so, for me, my writing is more of an activist outlook, of how I use my activism. Now, how I went from that into boxing writing is the real strange leap. And essentially, I was bored. I was living in a cabin in Alaska. I'd written a couple of books. I'd really done nothing but be an activist on or a writer on environmental issues since I was 16, 17. I mean, I dropped out of high school to do it. And I'd always been a boxing fan and I wanted to do something different. I earned a lot of money through a very stupid website and I'd always wanted to go to Las Vegas. And so I said, well, I'm going to go to Las Vegas and write a book about boxing. So I just shipped up in Las Vegas, started interviewing people. I was going to do a book on all the Las Vegas boxing characters, spent several months doing that and was very happy with it. My agent was very happy with it. And we sent it to a very extensive proposal to a lot of different publishers. We said, wow, this is really interesting. Boxing fans don't buy books. And so having spent, you know, 8 months working on this to no avail, I thought, oh, well, I guess that's the end of that. But a couple of people had seen me working in the media room at fights, and I got asked, first of all, if I could do some stuff for ESPN and then Reuters. And then HBO realized that I tended to get drunk with Burt Sugar in the bar and talk about boxing a lot, and they asked me to go on video and do all of that without the drunken bit for them, and just one thing led to another, really. So now I'm stuck.
I will say that my only interactions with Burt Sugar were drunk in a bar in Las Vegas. So
yeah,
that
ticks most of the Burt Sugar boxes, actually.
And usually he was either wearing pajama pants or like the most horrific golf pants I can think of.
He was particularly proud of these, I think they were bright red pants with lobsters on them. And,
yeah, the blue and red ones.
Yeah, that's right, that's
yes.
right. And as he would often say, he would enjoy, you know, when people would look at him and go, what are you wearing? He would like to say, you know, I'm the only person in Las Vegas with crabs on the outside of his pants. At which point you're like, first.
One of my favorite interactions with him, he was boasting that the whores in Atlantic City were better than the whores in Las Vegas. But he was drunk, so I have no idea how serious he was about that.
I'm sure somebody told him. He was all talk when it came to that. So he probably heard it from somebody.
Well, do you have any good boxing related yarns about Mr. Sugar?
Well, gosh, you know, I mean, the thing that I
any that are even remotely PG-13?
Remotely PG-13? Oh, well, that'll be easy. That'll shorten up the list. I'll tell you, here's the funny thing, right? We became very good friends. We did, like I said, a lot of stuff with HBO, and you know, he liked me, and I think he sort of liked taking me under his wing a little bit. But very early on, before he knew me, the Shane Mosley and Winky Wright were going to have their second fight at the Mandalay Bay. And as part of that, during the fight week build-up, there's like a little stage there on the way to the Mandalay Bay Event Center, and Bert was going to be there and with talking about they were going to show video of the first fight, and he was going to talk through it and invite different guests up for, you know, to go through various different rounds. And he goes, I'd only known him like a month or so at this point. And he goes, Kieran, I'd be honored if you come up to the stage with me and talk through one of these rounds. And I go, yeah, absolutely, sure. And I was very thrilled. What did I know? I just showed up. I'm like some whale hugger from Alaska. What the heck do I know about boxing? But here I have Flirt Sugar asking me up on the stage. And he goes, okay. He goes, for the next bit, I'd like to invite somebody up who's a fantastic writer. He's a wonderful young man. He's a very, very good friend of mine. Kevin Muldowney, get up here. And, of course, you know, just enough people that I knew were sitting there to see it and snigger at it that I got called Kevin an awful lot for a while after that. But but no, Bert was always good company. He would say the exact same things over again. He signed about 3 or 4 different books to me, and it has the same inscription every time because I think he just completely forgets. He would have so many interactions with people and use the same jokes over and over again. He forgot whether he'd used them or not. And each time he gave me the book, he'd be so happy at the inscription, and I'd laugh like I hadn't seen it before. And you know, and off we went. But yeah, it was one of my great joys for Fight Week for those couple of years, actually hanging out with Bert and doing those videos with HBO. He was he was larger than life. He was a very, very nice, kind person. He was one of those people who really did want to help folks who wanted to be involved in the sport or who wanted to learn about it. And he was really, really nice to me, and I should always be very grateful to him for that.
Boxing really, you know, they lost an icon with his passing. And, you know, that I guess unless you have something, you know, some burning question you'd like to ask Mr. Mulvaney before he jets off, I'd like to ask real quick.
No, go ahead.
I guess in that sense, you know, the kind of icons of yesteryear in boxing, Bert Sugar, even Don King, Bob Arum, you know, like these icons kind of just this past generation, you know, they're either getting old or gone.
I'd throw Larry Merchant in the mix too.
Yeah,
I was
Larry
just going
to
say Larry as well, know. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, these guys, they probably don't have a whole lot of time left. So my question is for this next generation in boxing, you know, and when I say icons, I mean that like these were guys outside of the ring, and then in this generation, the only real icons seem to be Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao. But outside of the ring, do you see any other kind of, you know, surefire icons in the
Kieran
sport?
Mulvaney.
Aside from Kieran Mulvaney. That's an easy
answer. It's different, isn't it? Because there are very few outlets now with massive reach in the way that there used to be even 20, 30 years ago. You could be the New York Times boxing writer and be a good writer and be somewhat larger than life. And the whole nature of that market has changed. And I think the whole nature of the business to some extent has changed. The promoters, I mean, Todd DeBuff is, I think, very effective, but he's not that kind of character that even his stepdad is. Oscar's obviously a whole other different ball of wax. And the most powerful man in boxing is a cipher. Very few people even know what Al Haymon looks like. And so I think it's just fundamentally a different business. Personally, I think it's kind of cool if the big icons in boxing aren't the people outside of the ring. I really do think it should be more on the fighters, and I hope that we see, when we look back, perhaps 20 years from now, on who are the icons of this particular period, that it's fighters, that it's not writers, that it's not journalists, that it's not promoters, that it's not managers. I also, part of me hopes that it's not going to be the likes of Adrian Bronner, unless, you know, he picks up his act a little bit. I hope there is somewhere. You know, even in the short period of time that I've been covering boxing, this is like the second wave that I've gone through of, oh, what's going to happen after X leaves, right? It was Oscar De La Hoya when I showed up because Tyson was already on his way out. It was like, we're doomed. Oscar's going to leave. What the heck do we do when Oscar retires? The sport is doomed. And then Floyd somehow makes himself into a superstar, and Manny Pacquiao does. And now it's like, well, we're doomed without Floyd and Manny. You know, there's nobody left. But I think as long as we have the focus on fighters as the fighters, and that there's an opportunity for good fighters, particularly fighters with good personalities and exciting styles, to keep coming through, then I think we'll be constantly surprised at how the sport finds new characters and new people to carry it. And personally, I'm happy if those of us who are doing the reporting on the sport are just the people doing the reporting and aren't the characters that people write about. The more that the spotlight is on the guys who are getting hit in the head rather than those of us who are writing about it and then going to have a whiskey afterwards, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. And also with that answer, we pretty much come full circle to what we started talking about, which was, why you write boxing and why that's good and why that kind of sucks and is ridiculous, which I can relate to. But Mr. Mulvaney, that was our half hour, and thank you so, so much for coming on here. That was a great talk.
No, I really appreciate it. Thanks very much for asking me on, and anytime. I'm always happy to come back.
All right, thanks, man.
We'll be asking you back. Thanks again.
Thanks. I'll bring Elizabeth next time.
Yeah, definitely bring Elizabeth. In fact, you stay home and we'll just give Elizabeth our number.
Okay, all right.
All right, thanks.
All right,
take care, man.
All right.
Karen Mulvaney, legend.
Class act.
Oh, definitely.
Class act.
How can you not be with that accent, though, in fairness? Pretty much whatever you say sounds cool.
He pulls more wool than a sheep shearer. Come on, let's be honest about that.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely has a way with the ladies, but we'll have to ask him about that next time.
Well, in a couple minutes, we have my good buddy Alex McClintock, also from Queensbury Rules, coming on here. We're gonna basically...
He just asked if he should call in now, so why don't we just tell him to
go ahead
and fire that up. But
please do. I need another accent in my life.
I just wanted to say my money on the next icon, the next future star, is a guy who likes to wear pink undies and smoke doobies and float in inner tubes and swimming pools, you know, when he should be training for his fight.
Is that Alex McClintock?
No.
Oh,
Julio,
okay.
Cesar Chavez Jr. But
oh, man.
One of these guys is going to emerge, if not as a great fighter, as a fan favorite. And somebody who
and speaking of iconic scenes, that like standing in his undies eating a bowl of cereal.
Yeah.
Wow.
Classic.
That dude has embraced the stoner lifestyle. Trust me, I know.
I mean, that was like the best scene on 24/7 since maybe like go back to Mayweather Hatton when Roger went Thanksgiving shopping.
That plus the psychotic stare during the face-off.
Oh, yeah. That was
that
awesome.
Shit was epic.
Yeah, we should give him a shout out to the man. I have no idea who he is, but maybe it's his real name, but James Bagg Jr. on Twitter, who has managed to capture screenshots of a lot of these moments and periodically drop them into our lives every once in a while.
Yeah, well, you know, we had Mr. Raskin on the show last week, and I got to think that in his day, that guy also had a little bit of pull. So who knows? There could be a whole bunch of little James Bagg Jr.'s running around.
Yeah.
Let me get McClintock on. McClintock.
Hey, guys. How are you going?
Hey, Alex. How's it going, man?
Yeah, it's good.
How
are
you doing?
I'm in Maine.
You're in Maine?
I am. It's
still one of the 50 states?
Very nice.
The northernmost state in the continental U.S. So, I have a quick question for you before we get into all the fights and stuff like that. Since this is going on today, you know, I think that it's a good topic to ponder on for a minute. So this morning, tickets for Floyd Mayweather versus Saul Canelo Alvarez went on sale. And of course, you know, as pretty much everyone predicted, they sold out in something like a minute or two. And pretty much nobody was able to get any substantial amount of tickets. And this has pretty much been the case for every Floyd Mayweather or Manny Pacquiao fight for a long time. So, my question is, you know, what good does this actually do for the sport of boxing and for fans? And feel free to say none, because that's fine with me.
I think to a certain extent, it probably attract a little bit of publicity when tickets sell out like that, which is probably a good thing.
Dude, Alex, just real quick. Dude, I'm getting a major broner listening to that accent. go ahead.
Bro sign.
It seems normal to me. I'm sorry, someone's knocking on my hotel room door. I'm sorry, this is very unprofessional. Let me get it.
Oh, what's going on here? We're gonna have a hit.
Front desk bringing
like
up condoms.
Jeez.
Sorry, guys.
No problem.
Okay, so I think it sucks. People can't get to the fights. Like, what are the fights for if people can't go to them?
Well, I mean, you know, it's one thing to watch a fight on TV, and I'm cool with watching a fight on TV. I'm not one of those people that's going to say, oh, you haven't seen a fight if you haven't seen it live. But at the same time, I would like to at least have the option to go if I wanted to. I mean, personally, I don't really have an extra, like, $1,500 laying around for my wife and I to attend. I know other people do, but I don't.
Yeah, it's really annoying because you're right. I mean, it outprices a huge percentage of the actual boxing fan market. And, you know, I mean, I hear stories. I know some guys through friends and things like that who are, you know, huge gamblers in Vegas, guys who play, you know, $5,000, $10,000 blackjack hands. And the casinos just throw them tickets to these type of events for nothing. And they don't give a shit. They don't like boxing. They're just like, oh, okay, that's something to do for an hour. And, yeah, that's not the kind of people who should ideally be getting a chance to see these kind of things. But I mean, what are you going to do? That's kind of the, you know, capitalist society, you know, the casinos buy all the tickets, or the ticket brokers can buy all the tickets, and people pay that kind of money for them, or they think it's good business to give them away to the high rollers. Then there's not much we can do other than, you know.
And then even more annoying is the fact that 5 minutes later, all the tickets that weren't on on Ticketek or whatever it is, immediately appear on the secondary market.
Right.
It's just...
Yeah.
It kills the fans.
And
at a higher rate,
too. Is that these casinos, you're never going to get an actual ringside seat for an event like this, because those aren't even for sale to the public. All that stuff's like VIP. So it's like the people who probably care the least about boxing get the best seats.
And you see it on TV when people don't turn up for the undercard. You know, if you don't want to turn up for the four rounders, I'm totally fine with that. Sitting there for 3.5-4 hours of boxing can be a bit of a stretch sometimes. But I mean, people only turn up for the main event, and when you've got a pay-per-view, sometimes rarely, the undercards are actually pretty good.
Most of the time, the best fight of the night is on the undercard.
Exactly, and it's just embarrassing to not have anyone there.
Yeah, and it's terrible. I mean, and it makes it a worse viewing experience on TV, too, when the crowd is just comatose and there's like four or five empty rows. You got Devin Alexander and Richard Schaefer sitting there and three empty rows behind them. You know, it doesn't – I mean, there's like no enthusiasm. You hear some faint echoes from probably like the hardcore who's in the back, you know, the nosebleed section. But, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, and a four-fight card, and I just feel like you're paying – those kind of prices to go to the arena. I mean, even $400 for the cheapest seat, you know, at least go see what's on the pay-per-view. I mean, I don't blame you if you don't want to show up at 4 in the afternoon or whatever to watch the four rounders, but at least go see four or five fights. I mean, for that kind of money.
Then again, I think what we also probably need to think of is that this fight, Canelo Alvarez versus Floyd Mayweather, is like your game 7 of the NBA playoffs or your game 6 of the Stanley Cup final, and the tickets are always going to be really expensive. There's always going to be lots of corporate giveaways, and there's not going to be that many tickets available for your average fan, because your average fan just can't afford to go to this kind of event.
Alex, what would the like Australian metaphor for that be? Would it be like the Melbourne Sydney cricket final?
No, it would be the AFL grand final, which is the highest consistently attended sporting event in the world.
Wow.
In any country.
Wow. That's
there
impressive.
You go. There's a bit of trivia for you guys. Aussie sports trivia.
Well,
AFL,
I
don't even know what sport that is.
Australian rules, people describe it as like a marathon, an 18-man marathon with a little bit of wrestling thrown in and some ball kicking.
Sounds awesome.
It's a mess.
a marathon with wrestling?
Well, I think that the ticket issue just points to the way that boxing fans are treated. And by boxing fans, I mean the people who will return no matter what, and the people who are going to buy a lot of pay-per-views, and the people who are going to watch it on HBO and Showtime, et cetera. You know, I think that, and I was having this discussion with somebody on Twitter earlier, but basically it just points to the fact that when decisions are being made in the sport, you know, they don't really have us in mind. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be voicing objections for this or that, but at the same time, you know, when these decisions are made, I don't really think that we're much of a factor, you know, in these decisions.
I know, but the problem is that we are the hardcore people are always going to turn up, so that promoters and networks can afford to ignore them. Take, for example, the outrage when Manny Pacquiao fought Antonio Margarito. I mean, people were howling outrage from the roofs, but then when it came fight time, if you went on Twitter, everyone was watching it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's kind of the same problem in a lot of things in life. Is like, one, you individually, there's nothing you can do about it. Whether you watch it or not, it's going to happen. So even if you're against it, you know, you're kind of helpless in these situations. But the other thing I would say is, you know, the fact of it is that they're in business to make money, and if they can sell out these tickets for these outlandish prices, that's what they're going to do. I mean, we can't say, you know, it'd be nice if they were somewhere where the average person could afford to do it. But, you know, I mean, I had friends who were, like, wanted to go to Vegas for Mayweather-Canelo, and I just immediately ruled it out because I knew how much the tickets were going to be, and it's just not worth it to pay that much to see one fight in boxing where anything can happen. You could have a headbutt in the second round. You know, you could have a boring 12-round Mayweather domination decision. There's just so many things that can happen. It's not worth taking that risk of, you know, unless you can afford it. You can't, you know, to spend $1,000 for a decent seat when you could end up walking away after like a 3-round headbutt technical draw. It's just not worth it. And also, I don't expect that there's going to be a very good undercard on this, because usually the highest profile main events have the worst undercards.
So, you know, that kind of like, I guess, gives me a little bit of a segue into this past weekend. Now, Alex, I know you wrote the recap for Adrian Broner, Paulie Malignaggi, but I just wanted to touch onto it real quick again and kind of get back into the, you know, current event stuff. But I saw what you had written about the fight, so I know what your thoughts were about it, and I agree that it was, you know, kind of surprisingly entertaining. So I just also wanted to get your thoughts about Adrian Broner in general from here.
The thing is, I feel like this is, again, one of those things where you or us as individuals might not like Adrian Broner, but, like, the momentum is there, and he has fans, and he has, and HBO Showtime is behind him, and it's just, it's a mess. Like, he's a disgusting human being. He's a misogynist. I've seen a lot of boxers with bad personalities, probably borderline personality disorders, and Adrian Broner is one of the worst.
Is there any chance that he's playing a character, trying to, you know, be controversial or get people to hate him?
I think he is, but I think he's bought into his own hype as well. I think he started playing a role, and now he is the role. I think.
Well, see, I just want to say I like Paul Malignaggi a lot as a person. I think he's a great commentator. I think he's funny, but I think he crossed the line just as bad, if not worse, than Broner did in this particular promotion as far as misogyny and, you know, anti-women rhetoric.
I agree with you, and I like Paul Malignaggi as well.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder if, like, we're not giving Broner a harder time because he's such an idiot in so many other ways, whereas with Paulie, we like him, so, you know, I felt like Paulie took it to a worse place than Broner did, it just in the one press conference that I saw.
It's, it's a bad choice to have to make when you have to choose between two, like, awful misogynists. But, I don't know, at least Malignaggi, you know, he was a good-ish loser until Broner brought that stuff back again. You know, his intention was to be gracious to Broner. He went up to Broner and, you know, patted him on the back, maybe gave him a kiss on the cheek. And then Broner was like, I took your belt and your girl. And then Paulie, who in his defense had been being punched in the head for 45 minutes, went apoplectically angry.
The Wanma referee was gambling defense.
Yeah, exactly, which I'm not entirely sure I buy. But, like, he just lost a big fight. Emotions were running high. And then, you know, Broner kicked him while he was down. I don't know if there's any...
I didn't fault... I mean, yeah, it was a distasteful scene, but I don't think that was the worst of what Paulie had said. That didn't bother me as much, the post-fight things.
How did you feel about that when he said it? Did you feel... It was kind of ironic after the... I was like,
why is this guy bragging about taking his side piece?
I felt kind of bad for Paulie, like, not, like, truly, like, I really felt bad for him, but I just felt bad for him because he just lost the fight. I thought he lost pretty clearly, and then this dude is like, you know, I mean, if you win a fight, you know, it's kind of like, I kind of feel like, all right, like, you should get to brag a little bit, but what Broner did was over, you know, it was crossing the line between bragging and just being a fucking douchebag. So, I mean, I kind of just felt bad for Paulie. And I was like, all right, just cut the camera, like, cut it away and get to, like, the studio because this is embarrassing all of us right now.
Yeah, and then Jim Gray, who is, like, a fly in the ointment, goes
the biggest
in there.
Asshole of any of those guys.
I know. They're talking about firing. People are talking about Paulie getting fired for saying a few stupid things. Jim Gray has been saying stupid things for 25 years. They haven't fired him yet.
I think he has the same deal with the devil that Buffer does.
Buffer's just got to deal with his plastic surgeon.
Yeah.
Dr. 90210 or whatever.
We'll find out Buffer's actually like 93 years old.
Well, speaking of things that you need sedatives for, Seth Mitchell won a unanimous decision over Jonathan Banks on the undercard of Broner Malignaggi, and so I wanted to talk about that briefly, even though I had to drink two or three bottles of Pepto-Bismol while watching it. It was, you know, it was upsetting. So I guess the only question I really have is what, you know, who wins in that fight really, and what did we learn about either fighter? What does it say about one guy or the other?
I want to know what the hell happened. Banks was in control and then just completely let his foot off the gas. I've virtually never seen a fight like that. It was truly perplexing, don't you think?
Well, it was, you know, I saw afterwards, like, a couple of, you know, people saying, I thought that, you know, Banks probably got bought off, you know, it was a fix and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, he's actually looked pretty mediocre for the first Seth Mitchell fight, you know, and that's not the first case of a guy who looked kind of mediocre before. I mean, probably the most glaring example would be Buster Douglas and Mike Tyson, you know, a guy who, like, looked kind of so-so before and then having a really great night. And, you know, maybe that's what happened.
Mike Tyson.
Of course not, you know, of course not. But, I mean, in terms
Seth Mitchell, you know, is no Buster Douglas either.
Well, yeah, of course not. But hey, that was the easiest friggin' analogy. You know, give me a break. But, you know, regardless, I think that Jonathan Banks probably isn't that good of a fighter. But it also says something about Seth Mitchell's chin and the way that he's been matched. That, you know, Banks kind of just laid up, and I think that he's more the type of fighter that he was in the second fight than he was in the first fight. Like, the first fight was kind of uncharacteristic for him almost. So, I mean, you know,
I think that's
needless to say.
Fair, you know, I mean, he caught him with enough punches to hurt him and finish him in the first fight. You know, here, yeah, it seemed like he was on the verge of doing it, and he just couldn't make it happen, and he just looked horrible the last 9 rounds of that fight. Like, he was just completely out of gas. I mean, I thought going into this that Mitchell, I had a lot of, I mean, I still do have, you know, huge doubts about how successful Mitchell can really be. And I thought Banks was probably going to TKO him again here. But I did think going in that Mitchell really needed to just blow Banks away to really completely erase the stain of what had happened. And, you know, he obviously didn't do that. I mean, he was hurt worse than Banks was during the fight. It's just that Banks did nothing for the last, you know, 3/4, and Mitchell was able to do enough to outpoint him. I mean, I don't think it bodes well for Mitchell's prospects, and I think it also depicts Banks pretty poorly, and maybe kind of does, like you were saying, Patrick, kind of reminds us that Banks is a good fighter, but, you know, he's not an elite guy, and I think what you saw here was two kind of, you know, average good heavyweights, just neither guy really having enough to, I mean, Mitchell just couldn't get into another gear to hurt Banks and to try to really dominate the fight, and Banks just seemed like he had nothing. And I don't know, I mean, maybe it has something to do with when the man in the black hat was seen in Banks' corner handing him a briefcase full of money, I don't know.
So, Alex, from on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being teenager cry for help, 10 being Kurt Cobain, how suicidal were you during that fight?
I was probably about a 6. I wasn't that far up. I just enjoyed Sekio Bika, Marco Antonio Ferraban way more than I thought I would. And then, you know, I can survive 6, 7, 8 rounds of terrible boxing. You know, you go to enough fights, you'll see a few terrible fights. It's what kills me is when you get a pay-per-view undercard or something where there's like a stretch there of like 5 or 6 terrible fights in a row. That's when I want to hang myself.
I think it's worse too. Like, a lot of times I host people over for fights, and it's a lot worse to have a fight like that when you're in a room full of people, because everyone, you know, half the crowd's kind of paying attention to it, and it just, I mean, if you're solo, you can basically just do, you know, do whatever you want. So, I mean, I was flipping back and forth with some other stuff at a certain point after maybe the 3rd or 4th round. I mean,
That's such a bad situation when you're there with people who you've invited over to watch the fight,
right,
and the fights suck. That's like when you put on a video when you're a teenager with your parents, and there's like,
yeah,
a hardcore sex scene.
You know, bad. Yeah, bad boxing is just really one of the most brutal things you can possibly watch. And it's funny because, you know, at any moment, I mean, look at the Mike Jones-Randall Bailey fight. That was terrible. And we were all just squirming around. And I think it was an NBA playoff game that night. And half the guys in the room with me were, you know, yelling at me to turn on the game. And luckily, we you know, we flipped back and forth. We came back like 10 seconds before that first punch. And that's the thing. At any time, it can get exciting. But, man, when boxing's bad and you have two guys who are just either unwilling or unable and, you know, to throw punches, it could be one of the most brutal things to watch on television.
So if you're Banks, if you're Mitchell's manager, who do you put him in with now?
Jeez, I don't know. I mean, how would you guys see like a Seth Mitchell, Deontay Wilder? You think Wilder just catches him something big and knocks him out pretty early?
Even though I think that Deontay Wilder is probably, you know, being matched correctly himself and everything, but I think that he definitely has more ability and talent and kind of a natural place in boxing than Seth Mitchell. So I don't think he's ready for that.
What about Mitchell against, say, Malik Scott or Brian Jennings, one of the smaller, light-punching American heavyweight prospects?
I would probably like his chances against Brian Jennings more, but at the same time, I don't even know if he's ready for that.
Yeah,
I think that he needs more confidence.
Pick him against anybody, even on that level. And I think a lot of it is a confidence issue too. That I don't know how the guy can keep believing in himself when it looks like he's, you know, takes a couple punches from a guy who's not really a big puncher and just gets so badly hurt and staggered.
Well,
you know,
he's got guard on his side. Didn't you see his post-fight interview?
What fighter doesn't? I'd like to meet an atheist fighter one of these days.
Yeah,
that would be interesting. Yeah, I remember Angel Manfredi for a little bit was doing the, like, I think it was like Angel Diablo Manfredi or something like that, and he was kind of like embracing that image until he went like super Christian. But other than that, I can't think of any.
Well, you know, I mean, God, I think God's got some time on his plate now. He's done helping Robert Guerrero, and Andre Ward doesn't have anything lined up, so why not get in Seth Mitchell's corner?
Why not? He's got a little extra time.
Yeah.
Well, hey, you want to take us into a Sakio Bika? Since he's,
sure, yeah.
since he's Mr. McClintock's countryman.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, that fight really did exceed expectations. And Bika, I guess, it was a majority decision over Marco Antonio Parabon, a kind of prospect who we weren't terribly familiar with going into it. I thought Bika clearly won the fight. It was exciting. There was times when it just looked like a drunken bar fight. I mean, these guys were just swinging away at each other. And, you know, it was classic Bika in a lot of ways. I mean, he definitely had some tricks and kind of was jumping in with his head there a little bit and getting a little rough. And ultimately, I mean, I think he, you know, he pretty... you know, I thought comfortably won that fight. The thing now, though, is now he's got one of these belts at 168, and I think he might be like Andre Ward's automatic challenger or something like that. But the thing with Bika is, you know, we've seen him against the elite guys in the division, and it hasn't worked out well. But I guess there's kind of two ways you could look at it. You know, has he done enough now in beating these prospects, Parabon, and I forget who the last guy that he beat. He TKO'd a guy, another guy who was kind of coming up the ranks. Does he deserve another chance to go after one of the top guys again? Maybe rematch Andre Ward? Should he just continue to be kind of like the number five guy at 168 and whoever wants to get up to the top has to go through him? I mean, do you guys see any good contenders, good young guys that maybe Bika would be a good litmus test for? Or would you rather see him fight the best guys in the division, like a Ward or maybe Frock? I mean, I don't know how realistic those are, but...
If I'm Alex, a contender, there's no way I want to fight Bika. Like,
if you're who?
If I'm a contender, there's no way I want to fight Bika.
Right.
You would know all about it the day after a Bika fight. Like, the way he punches with the heel of his hand, which isn't, like, he's not just slapping. That's, I think, an entirely deliberate move to hit people with the heel of his hand where there's less padding on the glove. He headbutts. I mean, this is, like, he likes to say that he's avoided. He's not really avoided. He's been in some big fights with some big guys. But this is the reason people don't want to fight him. He's not, he doesn't make a fun fight, I mean, apart from this one. And he doesn't make a good fight, really. He's in he puts himself in a hard spot with the way he fights.
To kind of piggyback off that, yeah, he has been in some big fights, and I don't know that he has a choice about being that kind of number 4, 5, 6 type of guy, because I don't think that he's ever really going to beat a Carl Froch or an Andre Ward necessarily, but he's a tough dude. He'll make the fight really rough for you, and, you know, I think that there were a couple cards against Andre Ward that were like total shutouts, but I thought that he took a couple rounds just by being a tough bastard and kind of roughing him up a little bit. But regardless, you know, I thought the fight was fun, even though it was really sloppy and like just kind of uncoordinated and stuff like that. But yeah, if there's one thing I take away from that fight, you know, and one thing that I learned was that I was wrong about Marco Antonio Parabon, at least in terms of how tough he was and whether or not he would be able to kind of compete in there, because he did. And yeah, you know, that's fine with me.
I totally second that. I saw Parabon in a couple of fights on TV down in Mexico, and I just thought he was rubbish. But
that's what I thought.
He's not as slow as I thought he was. His chin isn't that much of a liability if he can stand there with basically his hands at his waist and just, like, take Bika's shots on the chin for 12 rounds. And, you know, he's not that unskilled. I kind of got the feeling that in that fight, he just kind of did this Mexican macho thing where Baker put his hands down and was swinging at him like a caveman, and he was like, well, if this is the way it's going to be, this is the way it's going to be. And he, just
and he was arrogant about it, too. Especially he was arrogant about it during the fight, and then he was all pissy about it during the post-fight interview, too. So
I was really surprised by that interview.
And the translator didn't translate everything, because he was calling him a puto and stuff like that. He was kind of just, he was pissed about it.
Yeah, I know the job, and Alex, you speak Spanish, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I know the job of a translator is hard, but I do feel like a lot of times on HBO and Showtime, we're only getting like the last sentence that the guy says.
Definitely.
And it just seems like there's major content kind of being like ignored at times.
Mind you, what was that the old HBO translator? What was his name?
Ray Torres.
Yeah, the guy,
high-pitched voice.
He got everything, man. He got the pour some water on his balls from the Eric Morales fight.
Yeah.
Or the oh, that black guy, he hits hard in the Forrest Mayorga fight.
But yeah, I mean, it's a tough gig because the if you got Jim Gray there, like, spraying questions at you, and you have to, translate two ways, listen and talk at the same time. Tough gig.
Yeah, for sure. And also I think that it's kind of tough, really endearing yourself to the fans in that way if you're always having to speak to through a translator, and not necessarily in a way that I'm saying that you can't be a star if you don't speak English or anything like that. But I think it's kind of tough just getting your point across unless you're just a big knockout puncher or something like that, that's able to, kind of win the hearts and minds of the people, like a Felix Trinidad or something like that.
Or if you're a guy like Mayorga, you just transcend language barriers.
Yeah, you're sitting there drinking a beer and smoking a cigarette, during the post-fight interview. That transcends language, I think.
Yeah,
but,
actually, this fight, just real quick, this fight kind of raises an interesting point on that whole sanctioning bodies defense thing, because I was thinking, why would Parabon's people put him into this fight? It seemed like such a huge step up for him, but then of course, well, because there was some WBC belt on the line, and that has to be the only reason why this happened, because like you said, what contender wants to go up and fight Bika? And it's not like Parabon had ever fought anybody even in the top 25 in that division. So I mean, this was a huge step up, and you have to imagine that the only reason they did this was for that belt, which he somehow delusionally thinks that he now holds, regardless of what happened.
And it's like your Baker is living a lie.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that he called him out like that. I mean, I didn't. Did you guys think this was really that close of a fight? I mean, I thought it was like, I don't know, I thought it was like 8-4 Bika.
Yeah, something like that. 7-5, 8-4.
Maybe 7-5. I mean, maybe a draw if you were like Parabon's brother or something, but.
Oh, well, maybe it was just another case of the Pauly Malignaggi, Juan Manuel Lopez syndrome.
You're right.
Like too many punches in the head and then getting interviewed after the fight.
That we didn't touch on really before, but I was also really shocked by that Pauly. It seemed like when they were announcing it, like it felt like he had this kind of resignation, like he knew that he lost. And Pauly's a smart guy. I mean, he must have known that Broner had likely won that fight, and I can't believe he's gonna. I don't think Pauly's gonna pull a Tim Bradley and rewatch the fight and then start claiming that he won. I hope not, but I was really surprised to see Pauly kind of point at corruption and think that. I just was kind of shocked by that. I couldn't imagine him thinking that he had done enough to win.
Yeah, that whole situation was a little bit embarrassing. I think when any fighter starts going down that type of road in an interview, like in a post-fight interview type of thing, I think it's time to just kind of cut them off, I mean, I don't think that anybody should be disallowed from having an interview necessarily, but when they start going into, like, conspiracy theories or, like, just crass shit, they need to cut it off.
It's hard
to...
Yeah,
he had a point after the Juan Diaz fight, but this was, I thought, completely different.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say, it's kind of like Paulie's automatic setting is when he loses a fight to do this, like, big rant at the politics of boxing, which people at times cheer, but it just really wasn't the time or the place this time.
Boxing is bullshit, part two.
Yeah. At the same time, though, he was incredibly articulate in explaining what we might call, like, a soft corruption, where the house fighter always seems to get the decision. It wasn't the right time, but he explained it in a very clear and understandable way.
Yeah, I think that's why he's great. He's a great commentator, I think.
He's a good speaker in general, and I think that he's an intelligent, articulate guy, but yeah, I mean, you know, perhaps it's just not the time. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, I feel bad for him, to be honest. I want to take him out for, like, a slice of pizza or a manicure or whatever he's into.
what's your guys, like, just real quick rankings of former fighters turned commentators?
Got to have Malignaggi at the top, right?
There have been some bad ones.
Yeah, I think that Malignaggi does a really good job commentating in general. I think that he's good at kind of explaining the action in a way that doesn't really make himself sound like he's talking down to you. You know, like, I've been here, you haven't, so you don't know what you're talking about, which, like, Roy Jones has done a number of times. Although earlier on, I thought that he was a pretty good commentator. But, yeah, I mean, there have been some fairly bad ones, too.
George Foreman was pretty good, but he also tended to do that.
See, I couldn't stand George Foreman, other than just for pure comic relief. I just thought that – I thought when he was at HBO, he always fell into this tendency of trying to sell you that, like, whatever was you thought was happening in the fight, you know, that, well, look out, because at any moment, this guy, you know, John Ruiz couldn't land that one knockout punch on Roy Jones, and there's 10 seconds left in the 12th round, so don't turn away. You know, it's like, we're already watching. I mean, there's no wonder that the guy ends up being this, like, 100 millionaire salesman, you know, with his grills. You know, that always irked me about Foreman, but I mean, it led to some great, you know, great Larry Merchant responses. And so in that sense, you know, part of the way I view commentators, I just want to be entertained. I don't really need them to give me this, like, great insight into what's happening. You know, if they do, then good, you know. But my number one priority, I just want to have, a soundtrack to the fight that's entertaining and fun to listen to. And a lot of times that makes up for a bad fight at times. I mean, some of the horrible fights on HBO when Larry Merchant would just be shitting on them the whole time, that was worth tuning into, you know. But Foreman, I just never cared. I just thought his summit, like, I remember during the Trinidad Hopkins fight, he's trying to talk up Trinidad the whole time. You know, sixth, seventh, eighth round, it's clearly turning into this one-sided, and it just that was my problem with him. I felt like he was too often trying to sell the fight. But then some other guys like Sugar Ray Leonard used to do commentary too, and he's at times is pretty articulate and pretty charismatic, but for whatever reason, as a commentator, he just couldn't seem to come up with it, in, you know, on the spot. And so a lot of what he said was...
A lot of his stuff was just like, oh, yeah, I agree,
Yeah, and like I think
that,
he kind of
he
felt
did that
the same.
A lot.
I think it's kind of the same criticism I have of Andre Ward, too. I think when you get actually on the mic, like, it's hard to be critical when you're a fighter of guys who are other fighters, and I think at times they try to be too diplomatic. And,
And slip
you know,
into those... tired boxing cliches, like, oh, well, you know, styles make fights, you know, championship rounds, blah, 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 blah.
When a guy can go out on a limb and say, okay, I think this fighter is going to win, and here's why I favor him. And too many times with Andre Ward, it seems like he's kind of like, well, you never know, you know, both guys have their good points, and, you know, it just remains to be seen what's going to happen, and... It's like, of course it remains to be seen. That's why we're watching it. But what's your opinion?
What do you guys think about Antonio Tarver as a commentator?
Of who?
Tarver.
Antonio Tarver?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Patrick.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't really have a real strong opinion on him either way, although I was never really that big on him myself. I always liked... guys like even Emmanuel Stewart, maybe about 12 years ago or so, when he was like first kind of like, you know, doing it every so often on HBO, I thought he was really good. And towards the end of his life, he started getting just kind of funny. But I mean, like, Antonio Tarver is just a guy that I kind of just never really took on to.
I thought Tarver was good. I liked his personality. I thought it was fun sometimes when a fight got excited and you kind of heard him giggling and laughing and that kind of thing. But I did feel like I think he was a good analyst too. I guess maybe I'm just so biased toward Roy Jones. And when Tarver got that gig at Showtime, so many people were like, you know, making that comparison, and Tarver's so much better than Roy Jones as a commentator. And I just disagree. I like Roy Jones. I really think he's funny and engaging, and he does have some insight, and he just entertains me, and I like his banter with Kellerman and with Merchant and, you know, Lampley. I mean, yeah, those guys tend to you know, lavish him with hyperbolic praise for a lot of the broadcast, but I don't know. I just got a kick out of Roy Jones. So maybe some of that just has to do with being a Roy fan and not really liking Tarver in the first place. But, yeah, I thought he was really good on Showtime. I mean, I have to admit that. And I thought it was kind of unfortunate what happened to him, that he lost that job.
We can all agree that all of these people are better than Lennox Lewis, right?
Definitely.
He was horrendous. And Lennox Lewis seems like a smart guy, but again, it's like when you're on the spot and you have to just come up with something, some guys just don't have that. But I'm just, insight and all that bullshit out the window, I just love it when Roy Jones just says some stupid joke and then starts cackling. I think it's hilarious.
And he does have that, like real down-home Florida accent as well, which
kind of
comparable to George Foreman with the Texas.
Right, yeah. I mean, Foreman, you know, I was just such a big Merchant guy. Foreman, like everything Merchant would say, you know, Foreman seemed to take some kind of an issue with, and it just seemed like he was being kind of argumentative for no reason. But, you know, it led to a lot of classic exchanges, so.
Well, you know who's a little bit of a, I guess, controversial type of commentator is Teddy Atlas for Friday Night Fights. And, I mean, that's one guy that, you know, I've never really had a huge problem with him. And on the contrary, I actually think that he offers a lot of really good insights. But, you know, at the same time, he's one of those guys that kind of drones on and on. And so even though he's not a former fighter, you know, he's a former trainer, I guess. But that kind of, I just wanted a little bit of a segue into talking about last week's Friday Night Fights real quick. Ronces Barthelemy scored a knockout over Fosse Sakhririn. Now, I talked about that name last week. That's a pretty incredible name, Sakhririn. It's just it's something magical about it. But as Sakhririn as he was, he got hit with a body shot that put him down and out. And since we were talking about post-fight interviews, I thought that he had a fairly interesting one. And he was the guy that this weekend, when they asked him after the fight, what type of opportunities has being in the U.S. given you as a fighter? And he basically said, it's given me all the opportunities. I love being in the U.S., you know. And we were also just talking about guys who, you know, maybe don't speak English and what that could mean as a you know, potential superstar, I guess. But in any event, especially with these Cuban fighters who come across, who basically defect to the United States, who already have an amateur pedigree but don't speak English, you know, every so often we're kind of inundated with like a crop of these fighters. Where do you guys think that a guy like Barthelemy sits, you know, kind of in that ranking of those guys? And do you think that he could potentially go on to be, you know, not necessarily a superstar, but something popular?
I'm not convinced. I think he's probably at the far lower end of this group of Cubans that have come through, kind of on your level of like a Yordanis Despain. Just a guy who, you know, I feel like every time we see these Cubans on TV, we're always trying to be sold that this guy is not your typical Cuban, in inverted commas. And then they always are. They're always slightly too tentative, They're not used to the pro system. They sometimes fade in the later rounds. They don't put any mustard on their shots. And, you know, I'm just kind of, you know, at this point, unless you're doing pretty, you know, unless you're looking pretty special like Guillermo Rigondeau, I don't really have a lot of time for the Cuban fighters. I know that's a bit harsh, but there you go.
What do you think, James?
I'm in total agreement.
Well, damn. I guess that just kills my whole little segment.
Should I break down this undercard, or do you have anything to add?
Yeah, go for it. No, that was pretty much it.
Well, Caleb Truax, is that how you pronounce his name?
I think it's Truax.
Truax?
I reckon it's way cooler if it's
Why
Truax.
Did I make that like a French thing?
I don't know.
Weird. Caleb Truax stopped Donovan George. The only time I had ever seen this guy, he's a Minnesota local fighter, of course, was in you know, the fight that ended with us with Jermaine Taylor's memorable interview after he'd been knocked down and probably concussed and then just started kind of raving like a madman.
I love this, Taylor, baby!
Taylor won the fight. Yeah.
Yeah, that was bad.
So, you know, it was nice to see Truax involved in something other than that. But and this really kind of surprised me because Donovan George is a tough guy and he's fought some pretty good fighters and hung in there. And he just looked off the entire night. And I know that he had cut some weight to get down to this fight. I think he was fighting at 168 prior to this. And I believe he'd even fought heavier than that earlier in his career. But he was all the way down, I think, at 162 or below for this fight. So, I don't know. Anyone have anything to, you know, any guesses on was it the weight for Donovan George? Was it that he's had some tough fights, took a really kind of nasty beating against Stevenson, I think a couple fights ago against Adonis Stevenson? What was up with that?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, he I've never seen him look like that, you know, quite like that. I mean, he almost looked like a guy that's like shot because his legs weren't really there. He wasn't moving a ton. And it was like, you know, he was seeing these shots coming at him. It's not like he didn't see them because he was kind of bracing for a lot of them. But at the same time, he just couldn't really get out of the way and his counters were like totally off. So, I mean, I got to think that, I mean, he's not old, so I don't necessarily think that he's like a shot guy, you know, but I think that the weight and the beating from Stevenson, you know, maybe he needs a little bit of time off or something like that and not try to make that weight again.
It puts him in a really bad spot in his career too, doesn't it? Because now he's lost, what, I think he's lost 4 of his last 6 or something? And
yeah.
I mean, where do you go from there? You were looking like a pretty hot contender there for a while, and now you've lost a bunch on the trot. Who's someone he could fight? I mean, he doesn't want to fight a guy like Sakir Beka, like a gatekeeper in the super middleweight division. I think he needs a bounce-back fight.
Well, I think he was positioning himself to be that type of fighter, that maybe he could get on an HBO Showtime as a guy, you know, a tough, credible guy against some kind of young contender looking to take a step up. But, yeah, you lose to a guy like Truax, who doesn't really have a strong pedigree and, you know, was pretty soundly outclassed by a really faded Jermaine Taylor, even though he knocked him down. Yeah, you're right. I mean, this is a pretty big setback for him, I think. It's probably going to take a few fights maybe on the local circuit. He's from Chicago, and he's fought on some undercards here against, you know, a lot more marginal competition than what he's fought, you know, on his TV appearances. So I'm guessing he probably goes back to that and hopes to rack up a few wins and maybe, you know, hopes his name pops up for a bigger fight. But, yeah, I mean, if you're getting stopped by Truax, it's not, you know, now Truax is going to be in that position. Maybe somebody will try to fight him.
And I didn't think Truax looked that bad. I mean, maybe it's easy to look good when there's a guy standing in front of you who's punched, not doing very much, punching really slowly, his legs aren't there. But I thought Truax had a decent variety of shots. He went down to the body a bit. I wouldn't mind seeing him in with someone who's, you know, a new prospect or contender or even one of the, like, mid-range super middleweight.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's earned that. I didn't want to minimize Truax and say that he, you know, he's, but, you know, usually a guy doesn't go that far in his career with if he really does have some kind of special talent, you'd think we would have seen it already. But yeah, you're right. I mean, he's tough enough and he's a decent enough fighter. I anticipate he probably will. I mean, you guys who win on ESPN2, you'll end up back on that network, or you know, maybe something better comes along on an undercard on one of the premiums.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really want to see him on a premium cable undercard.
Well, like in a show extreme against some guy, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't mind him being like an opponent for somebody on like a HBO undercard or, you know, something like that would get him a little bit of money, because I think that performance was solid enough that he deserves, you know, a decent payday. But yeah, I'm definitely not going to be, I'm not really willing to be inundated with Caleb Truax, you know, billboards and shit like that in the coming months.
Truax Taylor too.
Well, oh man, I don't know if I could handle. I don't know if I could handle that type of post-fight interview again. That was just I all at once. I felt like overwhelmed and sad and depressed and really happy for him that he felt so happy about doing that. But at the same time, that was like draining.
It was tough to watch.
Like Quinsby Rules Radio, the crazy post-fight interview edition.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, there's an idea.
Do a whole show about that.
There's an idea. The next time that there's like a slow week or something like that, I vote that we have Alex McClintock back on and we do a show on that. Well, hey, I actually wanted to also get in a little bit of previewing for this next weekend. And so, you know, the demigod himself, Triple G, Gennady Golovkin, is going to be fighting Mack the Knife, Matthew Macklin, who is, in my opinion, a good fighter, a very solid middleweight. And even so, I think that Golovkin's, you know, his aura has swelled so much that it's like, you know, even with Matthew Macklin, who is, in my opinion, just a really competent fighter, you know, he's a good fighter. I don't really see anything, you know, necessarily wrong with him or anything that would make me think that Golovkin's just going to really walk right through him. But even so, that's basically what's being talked about, is what's next for Gennady Golovkin after this fight. So seriously, has Golovkin's, you know, have his testicles just gotten so big that they've engorged so much over everything surrounding talk of the guy? I like him. I like watching him. I like him watching him knock guys out, but Is this, you know, is he legit, and should we really be expecting him to walk through Matthew Macklin? Anybody?
I think he probably will. I think Golovkin is, obviously, he's a massive puncher, and he's the odd massive puncher because of his amateur experience, that he knows exactly how to set up his shots. And Macklin is a really solid guy, but and he's solid in both senses. He's skilled and he's a muscular, you know, strong middleweight. He's going to be coming forward, but I don't see what he offers that Golovkin hasn't seen before. Golovkin's had over 300 amateur fights, and at a certain point, you've almost seen it all. And a guy who's as orthodox, who doesn't do anything particularly differently, a guy like Macklin, isn't going to offer much of a challenge to Golovkin. What do you guys think?
Well, I don't know. I think this will definitely reveal the most information we've had to date about Golovkin as a professional. You know, because Macklin, like you said, I mean, he is a very competent fighter and a full-size middleweight. And we've got comparisons with his fight with Sergio Martinez and with Felix Sturm. He's fought against some of the best guys in the division and the best guy in the division. This will be seeing him against Golovkin will finally give us some kind of evidence as far as where Golovkin's place is. I mean, a lot of people already have him as, like, I think somewhere between Carlos Monzon and Marvin Hagler as the greatest middleweight of all time. But, you know, his resume on paper, I mean, I think his reputation has exceeded his actual accomplishments in the ring. And it's not to say that those people are wrong, but it's just that in boxing, you know, we don't know until we actually see it. And I think that if he walks through Matthew Macklin, definitely have to give him a lot of credit. Because Macklin's tough, he's experienced, he's fought on this level. He's a much better opponent than guys like Gregor Proksa, Gabe Rosado. So, I mean, I'm excited for it. I mean, I don't know, you know, a lot of people, I think, made a little bit more out of the trouble that Macklin was giving Sergio Martinez than what I saw. And I'm going to pull the old card. Yeah, I was actually at that fight, so I had a, you know, really much better view than you guys did on TV. But I didn't think Macklin really troubled Martinez too much. I mean, I know he knocked him down, but I honestly felt like watching that fight that Sergio could and then did take over at pretty much any point that he wanted to. I think part of what surprised Martinez there was that Macklin was a lot more patient and kind of, in a way, tentative more than he expected him. I think he expected Macklin to kind of just bull rush him, and Macklin didn't do that. He tried to box him, which did, I guess, win him a couple rounds early. I mean, I don't think that Macklin can do that same kind of thing with Golovkin, so I'm not really sure. Yeah, as far as Macklin's prospects of winning this fight, I don't know. But, you know, I do think that, I don't know, I'd be kind of surprised if Golovkin's able to just get in there and just batter him around like he did to Gabe Rosado, or somehow catch him with a, you know, one punch like he did with Ishida. I don't see that happening. I think that Golovkin might end up, you know, if Macklin tries the same kind of techniques he did against Sergio and comes out and focuses on defense and just tries to kind of move around and box, it might unfold in kind of a similar way that the Sergio fight did, where it's not a very action-packed fight, and then maybe in the late rounds Golovkin catches him or Golovkin kind of takes over and wins the decision. But, you know, blowing him away, then, yeah, then you definitely have to say Golovkin's at worst the number two middleweight in the world.
I think that's kind of how I see it, is that, you know, Matthew Macklin is a really solid guy who thus far has, you know, I thought that he maybe edged out that Felix Sturm fight, and basically I thought that, you know, he was doing well against Martinez. I don't know that he was winning a ton of rounds, but, you know, he was doing well. And so I think that he also could be a good, like you said, a good kind of barometer as to how legitimate Gennady Golovkin really is, because Macklin's got a good chin. He's a tough guy. And if he's able to really just kind of walk through Macklin, I think that that's, and, you know, maybe you're going into this fight believing that Golovkin is the real deal. And so if so, that's cool. I like the guy. You know, he has a lot of amateur experience. He's not just some dunce that's walking around throwing clubbing shots. But, you know, personally, I think that Macklin is probably going to give him a little bit of trouble. And if he doesn't, then that's saying a lot about Golovkin.
Well, can I ask, if Golovkin were to win a decision over Macklin that kind of similar to what Broner did against Pauly, will he get the same type of heat that Broner did? People saying, you know, oh, this guy's all hype, you know, he was exposed, he didn't put Macklin in the hospital or the morgue, so therefore, you know, he's out of my pound for pound top 50.
Yeah, he probably might pop it like Broner. People dislike Broner on a deeply personal level, whereas people like Golovkin because, you know,
I expect a lot more rationalizations if somehow this fight goes the distance and Golovkin and Macklin has moments of success and it's like an 8-4 decision for Golovkin. I imagine people will paint this in a more positive light than they did with Broner.
Yeah, and I just want to say I'm not like some huge Golovkin fanboy. I just don't think that Macklin offers anything particularly different that Golovkin can't deal with.
Right.
A big particular fight won't be that difficult for Golovkin, and I think he'll probably take Macklin out around the 6th to 8th round, I reckon.
Ooh. That's kind of going out on a little bit of a limb there. I mean,
you gotta peg Golovkin to be the winner, I think. I think that if you're examining everything and where they are in their careers and et cetera, I think that you probably should peg Golovkin to be the winner. I just expect there to be a couple of hiccups along the way.
Yeah, it's hard to envision any kind of scenario in which Macklin can win just because he's not, you know, he's good at a lot of things. He's not great. It doesn't seem like he has a whole lot of power, so I'm not sure if he'll be able to hurt Golovkin, who seems like he's got a pretty sturdy chin. But at the same time, you know, Golovkin hasn't fought a lot of big punchers as a pro. I think the thing, you know, I agree with you stylistically, Alex. I think that he's not going to offer anything new. I think what he will offer is size and experience. He's a full-fledged middleweight, and he's fought the best in the division. And so I think there will be he's going to be a lot more confident than most of Golovkin's opponents have been.
How do you reckon that'll play into the way he performed? The aura of just stepping into the ring with a guy like Gennady Golovkin, who at this point most people think is just a phenom, a killing machine. Do you think that'll affect Murray? Macklin, sorry?
I don't know. I think it would affect him more if Golovkin had been knocking out real top-ranked middleweight contenders. Because I think Macklin can look at Golovkin's resume and say, okay, you know, he knocked out Ishida with one punch. He stopped Proksa. He stopped Gabe Rosado, who's a junior middleweight and not really like a top-ten contender in either division, 154 or 160. You know, Proksa was kind of a credible fighter, I guess, but we didn't know a lot about him. And how did Proksa end up getting his belt? I think he beat like Sebastian Sylvester or somebody like that.
Yeah,
you know,
like really embarrassed him though.
Yeah, but I mean, I think this isn't like Michael Spinks fighting Mike Tyson. You know, I think Macklin can look at the resume and at least tell himself, look, I'm a better fighter than any of these guys on here. I've fought Sergio Martinez when he was pretty, you know, basically in his prime. Still, he fought Sturm. You know, I don't think the aura is going to affect him. I mean, it shouldn't.
Well, I don't know. I think that maybe he could be going in, within the corner of his mind. But at the same time, I kind of lean towards, you know, not really believing that that fighters go into fights afraid or negotiate afraid or anything like that, you know. A lot of fighters are called pussies, or, you know, they're ducking such and such guy, or they're afraid such and such guy. 99% of the time, I have to think that that's probably not the case, you know, and there's a reason why, you know, these certain types of personalities are drawn to the sport, and most of the time, I don't think these guys are afraid or anything.
Well, and Alex, the other thing is, like, he's already fought a guy with that aura, because when he fought Martinez, he was coming off of the Paul Williams and knocking Zurich down 18 times, so... You know, he's had that experience, and he seemed like he handled himself pretty well in the early rounds of that fight.
That's
so
true. And I've spoken to Daniel Gill about this as well, about fighting Gennady Golovkin, and he himself has said, he said exactly what you said. His point of view on it was, well, who's Golovkin beaten? You know, he might be good, but he's never fought a guy like me, which I suppose is what Macklin's probably telling himself as well.
Well, what about the undercard of that, James?
Yeah, I guess we should bust this out here. Thomas Oosthuizen, the South African prospect at 168 pounds, fighting Brandon Gonzalez, undefeated fighter. I think they're both undefeated, actually, although Oosthuizen had a draw with Chilemba a couple years ago. I don't know a whole lot about Brandon Gonzalez, so I guess I'm asking you guys, you know, I'm more familiar with Oosthuizen, so I always favor that guy in these kind of fights, but it looks like a pretty legit fight, two up-and-coming super middleweight contenders. Do you guys have any insight on Gonzalez? Are you guys looking forward to this fight?
I am.
Go ahead, Alex.
Good. I'm glad that Tommy Oosthuizen isn't fighting on Friday Night Fights, because I would not want to see Teddy Atlas try and pronounce that name. I think it's going to be a good fight. Oosthuizen, he's a big, big super middleweight. He's about 6'4" and a southpaw. And, I mean, he's going to give problems to every single person he fights. But Brandon Gonzalez, you know, he's like a fun fighter. He likes to get in there and put his head on people's chest and bang away. And I'm not really sure what's going to happen. I think Oosthuizen should be able to outbox him from range, but I think there'll be a few fun moments in there. What do you think, Patrick?
Yeah, I basically agree with you. I think that Oosthuizen is kind of a gangly, awkward guy in general. I think that he's going to be tough for just about any fighter to deal with stylistically. But at the same time, he also, a handful of fights ago, you know, I don't have it pulled up in front of me right now, but there was maybe three or four fights ago where he was just absolutely getting nailed over and over and over again, and he was not moving his head at all, and he wound up winning the fight, but at the same time, it was just like he got hit a lot, and his face looked like shit afterwards. And Brandon Gonzalez, he actually was on an ESPN2 Friday Night Fights card earlier this year in like January or February, and he won I think it was an 8-round decision. And he's kind of a cagey guy. He's, you know, to me, he doesn't really look super talented, but he just kind of looks like a really solid guy. You know, his punching power is not great, but just enough that I think that he could be giving Oosthuizen some trouble. I think it's an interesting fight, if nothing else, going in. So I would kind of peg Oosthuizen to win just because I think that his range is going to make a difference, but it's interesting, and I'll definitely be watching. What do you think, James?
Well, like I said, I mean, I probably have seen Gonzalez before on ESPN2 if he's been on there, but I don't know him too well. I do like Oosthuizen a lot. I'm trying to remember the fight. Did he fight that guy Marcus Johnson?
Yeah, that was the one.
That was a good, really good fight. I mean, I think Oosthuizen's talented. Like you said, he's very tall and kind of rangy. So, you know, as far as this particular matchup, I mean, I'm looking forward to it. I guess anytime a guy's undefeated like Gonzalez, you know, there's a possibility. I just don't remember him, so it's hard for me to really, you know, break it down that thoroughly. Other than I like Oosthuizen, I'm familiar with him, and I've for the last year or so kind of been expecting him to move up the ranks and maybe eventually. I think at one point he was rumored to be fighting Carl Froch, although that fell apart. You know,
yeah,
I think he's going to get up there.
I think he's kind of been inserted into the drawing hat of a few fight negotiations with bigger guys in the last year or two. But I don't really know how much guys, you know, with bigger names and who have better options feel about getting in with a guy that's 6'3", 6'4", you know, a southpaw weird style.
And it's, like, very clogged at the top now in super middleweight with Frock and Ward, and they might fight each other. And then you got Adonis Stevenson moved up, and now he's a light heavyweight champion. So there are some guys in that next level. We talked about Beaker earlier, but there are a couple guys in that next level who would be interesting fights and a couple guys on the rise, and you get guys like Edwin Rodriguez. So, you know, maybe somebody emerges from that pack because Andre Ward is definitely going to need some opponents in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I tend to agree, and I think that if Oosthuizen is able to kind of pull out this fight and look impressive, then I think that might open up a few options for him. Although I don't really know at this point, like the undercard of a Golovkin fight, even though this one I think is probably going to be pretty fairly entertaining. I don't really know that Golovkin pulls like his numbers are that great or anything. So I'm not sure how many opportunities it'll actually create for Oosthuizen if he wins, but hopefully something. Well, actually, and speaking of kind of on the undercard, Willie Nelson is fighting Lucien Cuello on the opening bout of that fight card. And so basically, you know, I'd seen Willie Nelson. He's been on a handful of undercards of bigger fights. And from what I've seen of him, he's kind of a guy that doesn't really have a solid identity in the ring, because I've seen him kind of try to be slick and bounce around a little bit. I've also seen him kind of, against certain guys, be more of a power puncher and look for a one-punch knockout type of thing, and he has scored a couple of pretty eye-popping knockouts. But still, you know, I have to wonder a little bit about what exactly he's going to wind up being in the ring. And so I wanted to just kind of touch on that fight a little bit. You know, if you guys know much about Lucien Cuello?
I went back and watched one of his fights, his most recent fight against Joaquim Carneiro, who was like a bit of a caveman out of Brazil. And I don't know, he doesn't seem to offer much. He's kind of a solid fighter. He's not one of those guys that comes out of South America and sets the world on fire like Lucas Matisse or Marcus Maidana or Edwin Valera. He's just one of those average guys, maybe a bit more like Freddie Hernandez. I don't really see him threatening Willie Nelson. What do you think, James?
I mean, I'm kind of on the same page. I think the one encouraging thing, you know, Coelho's been in there. He's fought guys. He's fought a couple big names, and actually his only two losses are to Saul Alvarez and Chavez Jr. So he has fought better competition than Willie Nelson, which is always somewhat encouraging. You know, it's always a little dicey when you look at a fight like this, and there's a contender fighting against kind of an unknown fighter from South America, and you look at their resume, and there's just nothing on there. And Nelson wasn't really, I think, seen as like a blue chip prospect until, and maybe he's still not really viewed that way. So there's still a lot of questions about him. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I hope it could be a good fight. I guess you got to favor Nelson, but you know, I think it's fine for an opener on a triple header.
Does Willie Nelson give either of you guys like Paul Williams vibes? I know it's
well,
probably,
yeah. I mean, definitely, like, yeah.
It's nothing to do with style. They look like totally different when they're actually fighting, except that, as Patrick said, Willie Nelson kind of just like doesn't really seem to have a style yet. But yeah, that he's 6 foot, what, 2 or 3, and he's a junior middleweight, and he's got a big bald head. Makes me nostalgic in theory.
You know, the only way I feel that it's possible for Willie Nelson to become a superstar is for him to get caught with like 3 ounces of weed on the tour bus.
He needs to come out to his walkout song needs to be Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain or Redheaded Stranger. That would be
cool. Or when he fights abroad and needs to be on the road again.
Yeah, I like it. why are we on this blog talk show? We need to be managing fighters, guys.
Yeah, this is some great idea. We should get him like a gray ponytail too.
That's the next logical step. Everybody knows that.
All right. Well, Patrick, looking here at this outline, I know the fans are dying to get some really in-depth analysis of Gregor Proksa and Sergio Mora on Friday night fights. But, I don't know, with 8 minutes left here, I was wondering if maybe you could touch on this. Apparently, it looks like these Garcia Judah 2 rumors have kind of flared up your anal cancer.
Yeah, a new
those
hemorrhoid
were your words.
I
inserted the anal part, of course, but... one of the questions you'd asked was, what type of cancer does this rematch give you? And, man, I agree. That is not good.
Well, I hate to pass up the opportunity to start capping on Sergio Mora because, you know, I'd really love to. But we'll pass on that this week and just say that they're fighting on this next coming Friday night fights, Proksa and Sergio Mora. But this Garcia Judah 2 business, you know, I talked about it really briefly earlier today, and I think I tweeted about it. But for me, the bottom line is this. You know, I have no problem with making rematches of close fights, controversial fights, really good fights. You know, when fights happen, you know, I didn't even have a problem with Juan Manuel Marquez versus Juan Diaz 2. A lot of people did because Juan Diaz had lost to Malinaji or had looked bad against Malinaji in the meantime. And, you know, a lot of people didn't like it. I was cool with it because I was like, well, you know, the first fight was good. The second fight's probably going to be good too. It was more one-sided, but, you know, Juan Diaz still came forward and still threw a lot of punches regardless. Point is, Garcia Judah won. It was only good, and I put good in quotation marks, like on accident. It wasn't supposed to be good, and going through the first maybe 7 or 8 rounds, it wasn't that good. it was pretty much Garcia beating up on Judah, who was kind of just getting outclassed a little bit. And then all of a sudden at the end, Garcia seemed to run out of gas, and that was that. And then all of a sudden it was like kind of an interesting fight. To me, that's not really the type of fight that screams rematch. You know, I didn't have it that close anyway. I didn't think that it was like a super close fight. But, I mean, regardless, you know, Zab, I guess, deserves something for his troubles. I'm just – but Garcia Matisse is what everybody wants. That's what everyone wants. You know, aside from Zab Judah fans, nobody wants to see Garcia Judah too. So – for me,
my commentator is out there somewhere with a sign on a picket line campaigning for Garcia Judah 2, I reckon.
Who?
Mike Coppinger.
He's a big
legend,
Judah fan.
The world's biggest Judah fan.
Yeah.
But,
and that'll be great, because in the lead-up, he can give us training camp updates and things like that and tell us how Judah's in the best shape of his life.
Then just put that forward and say, you know, I'm a huge Judah fan, that rematch should happen. Otherwise, everybody else wants to see, you know, Danny Garcia versus Lucas Matisse.
But Garcia's a repeat offender, because he did this with Eric Morales as well.
Yep.
Yeah, and I'm kind of surprised.
And then Garcia Holt, too, that'll be good next summer.
Yeah, and Nate Campbell the summer after that.
Yep.
For a minute there, they were talking about rematching Amir Khan. So
that's fine.
You know,
if that happens, I think that's fine with me, because for one thing, the first fight was entertaining as hell, but also it's a different circumstance. You know, Khan at the time was like the man, and you know, one of the top guys in the division, gave Garcia that opportunity. That's basically what Garcia's made his name on. So in that, I mean, yeah, that was, you know, yeah, he knocked him the hell out. But if anybody deserved a rematch, I think Khan does, just because of the circumstances in that fight. But when you're going up, when you're a young contender and you're going up fighting these like older names and you beat them pretty convincingly, there's no need for a rematch. They're not doing any. That didn't do anything for his career. Danny Garcia is where he is now because he knocked out Amir Khan.
Well, let me ask you guys a quick question, like, you know, I guess our last question or so regarding this topic. If this fight doesn't get made, Garcia Matisse, that is. Are you willing to step up and just say, well, Danny Garcia is flat out ducking Lucas Matisse?
Well, I'm not going to say that, because as the fighter, I mean, I would blame the promoter more than anybody. I don't think it reflects terribly. Well, nobody's going to go around, you know, giving Garcia like a badge of courage, but. I think the fault has to be with Golden Boy for just seeing this as a kind of a money grab opportunity. And hey, we could do a rematch, so why not do a rematch? We'll protect Garcia a little bit longer.
Especially when they've bragged about, you know, not letting fights marinate too long, a la Bob Arum. It would reflect terribly on Golden Boy more than anything else.
Yeah, there's really just no excuse to not make the fight. There really isn't. Neither guy is a huge star, you know, so there's not really any ego that I can see getting in the way of getting that fight made. And then the whole promoter nonsense doesn't jive either, because they're both with the same promoter. It's and the same advisor or whatever you want to call it. It's the easiest fight to make. It's the easiest bigger fight to make as I see it. So, and especially in a division like that, it just sucks to leave loose ends. But we have a little bit less than 2 minutes left. So I guess, unless you have something
well,
in particular you'd like to say.
I was going to throw your question out, Alex, if you could give us 60 seconds. How did you get into writing?
Well, I did journalism at university, and I'd always been a boxing fan, but more of a casual one. I started to get really into it, and I actually picked up boxing myself. And then... I started writing for Queensbury Rules, and then really the Queensbury Rules has been my ticket to success. Now that I've written here at Queensbury Rules, I'm writing for The Guardian regularly, contributing to all sorts of places, Vice Magazine, and yeah, I'm like a professional writer now, which I like can't believe.
That's awesome.
Living the dream.
And a dang good one, if I may say so myself, you know, especially, you know, you kind of have your, like, you do the schedule every week, and, you know, there's kind of, like, little things you do here and there, but when you actually write, you're a good writer, and I appreciate you coming on today and giving your insight on all this bull jive and boxing.
And we hope that your back.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
We hope that your back's not sore for carrying Tim Starks the way that you have been.
Yeah, I know, man. That guy is just the weakest link. He's... Nah, thanks so much, guys.
All right. Thanks, Alex. Thanks a lot.
See ya.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Take it easy.